Hi, welcome to the Lost Souls of Detroit podcast, where we drink spirits and talk souls. More specifically, we're going to be talking about some influential figures of Detroit you may have heard of but know nothing about, famous or infamous, while drinking spirits, courtesy of usually my co-host Max Miller, but today I got it. Max, you know though, so how about you tell us what we're drinking today and introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Max. I'm from the Detroit area, have grown up here, lived here my whole life, and it's about all you need to know about me. But more importantly, the whiskey. Today, you so kindly picked up for us two James Catcher's Rye whiskey. This is a Detroit native.
Yep, it's a rye whiskey, surprisingly. Catcher's Rye is a rye. But it's from Two James Distillery, which is a distillery in Corktown.
Nice.
In Detroit. And they have been around, I think, for, I can't be sure, but like maybe a decade or so now. They have
it is a spirit of Detroit.
It is truly a spirit of Detroit. And we did a test run of this podcast, and we let the viewers or listeners know that the original name of this podcast was going to be Spirits of Detroit. I would like to know everybody to know that we are creative, but the Freep already took that as
more creative than us.
Yes, and as we learned, the Freep has longstanding roots in Detroit. So they
stay tuned for more.
Yes,
how about that.
The Free Press, you'll never believe anything you hear about them. Click here for more.
Journalists hate this one trick.
Podcasters hate this one newspaper. Just kidding, Freep. I love you. But they took the name. But we want to, with the whiskeys we do here, we're going to want to do mostly Detroit whiskeys, our Michigan-based whiskeys. I know we won't do all of them because there is just a wide world of whiskey that it would really be doing ourselves a disservice if we only did Detroit and Michigan. But I thought, why don't we start it out with this Catcher's Rye? But they got a tasting room downtown here, or in Corktown. Cool. You ever been to the Two James tasting room?
No, but you're telling me about it before. They had some crazy cocktails.
It's really cool. They have the cocktail that I had, I went last spring. It was this cocktail called Springtime for Hoffa.
That's a cool name.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I really enjoy their tasting room. Small, but if it's like 50 people, I mean, during COVID, who knows? I don't even know if they're open right now, but love to support a local business, and they're doing cool stuff. And they actually, I do know that during the beginning of COVID, they created like a bunch of hand sanitizer. So
that's cool. So did Motor City Gas.
Yeah, which is what we were drinking, Motor City Gas. Delicious, what we were drinking on our first podcast run. And then we did another random podcast a few weeks ago.
And we finished it.
And we finished it. I drank a little too much of it. But
it was fun, though.
It was fun. Yeah, no. There's nothing like drinking delicious whiskey. So cheers, and let's get started.
This is good.
Wow. I like it. I've never had the Catcher's Rye. They have a couple other bourbons and whiskeys that I have had. I've never had the Catcher's Rye, which is why. The Grass Widow.
Grass Widow.
That's the bourbon that they have. And then they have like Jay Riddle's peated bourbon or something.
This is really good. It starts sweet. Like when you first drink it, you think it's gonna be tasting like caramel.
Oranges, yeah.
Oranges, and then it finishes just like dry and earthy.
Yeah.
Like it's pretty abrupt. That's delicious.
Yeah, it's pretty like a lot of depth in the flavor profile for sure.
Super woody in the aftertaste. Nice. Two James, Catcher's Rye.
Okay,
and
so
this is pretty cool. Are those the two James?
That is, yeah, that must be the two James. James R. Landrum and James M. Landrum. Or James
Are
B. Landrum brothers? And James M. Landrum.
I hope, father-son duo?
I hope they're a father-son
they're
duo.
Like, they're like a George Foreman type deal.
Yeah,
like all eight brothers named George.
George Foreman and George Foreman. Not that George Foreman, but that George Foreman.
George's sons are literally named George 1, George 2, George 3, and George 4.
Yes.
And then what's his daughter's name? Georgina or Georgette
or something. I don't know. But yeah, everybody, highly recommend. Highly recommend. But given this is our first episode, I think it's fair to note that a lot of people that we're going to be talking about, you're going to have heard of, but you might not know like anything about. We're hoping to cover some of the pillars of Detroit history, like Henry Ford or Kwame Kilpatrick. But most of these we cover are going to be people that will ring a bell, but you're not going to know like a single thing about them. But so on that note, today we're talking about Joseph Campo. Have you heard of Joseph Campo prior to our originally recording of the podcast?
Prior to that, nothing more than the street named after him.
So, Joseph Campo is known to most Detroiters and Metro Detroiters because it is the main drag that runs north-south through Hamtramck, which, for those of you that don't know, which I'm not sure, if you don't know what Hamtramck is, this may not be the podcast for you, but hey, welcome.
Keep listening.
We're glad you're listening, yes. It's a little town that was originally created by Polish immigrants that is surrounded by Detroit as a whole.
Spelled really weirdly.
Yes, it's spelled Hamtramck. You know, you gotta love
a vowel there.
You gotta love words that have three consonants in a row. There's always,
especially MCK.
Yeah, mk. I'm sure it's based off a name, and maybe we'll do a podcast on this Hamtramck fellow at some point.
Cool.
But it actually goes all the way down from the riverfront in Detroit, pretty much all the way up to Conant Street on the east side of Detroit. If you've ever gone to a Detroit City FC soccer match or gotten some OG Poonchkies on Fat Tuesday, there's a good chance you've driven up and down Joseph Campa, or if you've been to any little dive bar in Hamtramck. Hamtramck is a really cool cultural place. Very strongly Middle Eastern in population now. Not many Polish immigrants left, but the Polish influence is still there because the Poonchki's on Fat Tuesday, and
yum.
There's like a few great Polish restaurants down there. But yeah, so it's named after the Joseph Campa Street is named after the man himself. So let's learn a little bit about him, huh?
Please.
So Joseph Campa was born February 2nd, 1769, to Jacques Campa and Catherine Menard. I don't think of any relation to the department store Menards, but I guess you never know.
It's true.
But he was born in Detroit, which is already an important tidbit to note, because you could make an argument that Campa is Detroit's first famous native. He was only born 68 years after Detroit's founding by the Europeans, of course. And the city's population at the time of his birth was likely under 1,000 people of of European descent. Again, you have to remember population numbers. They just decided not to count Native Americans. But yeah, under 1,000 people. Detroit now has a population way lower than it did at its peak, and its population is still pushing 700,000 people. So that gives you a little bit of perspective as to what Detroit was like in 1768 compared to now. I mean, Detroit really didn't boom until... population wise, it grew and was like a major city, but like Cincinnati was way bigger than Detroit until pretty much the Industrial Revolution. People came down here, and then cars. And when cars came about, and a future member of this podcast recording, Henry Ford. Yeah, that's when it blew up. So before that, it was especially back in the 1700s. It was more of like a military settlement, and eventually throughout Campo's life, a small city. But Campa came directly from what was already considered at that time Detroit royalty. His grandfather, also named Jacques Campa, like his dad, came to Detroit along with his brother Michel in 1703, 2 years after Detroit's founding, for those who are counting, as a secretary and officer for Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac in the French military, who you may know is the founder of Detroit or the namesake of Cadillac automobiles. Who we definitely will be doing a podcast on later. I know there are a lot of people's names you're going to hear in this who we may do episodes on later, and Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac is one of them. Because just a little tidbit of information, he was the founder of Detroit, very famous. He's a statue in the middle of the city, but by all accounts from historical documents, he was one of the dumbest military officers in the entire French army. So I don't really know much about him, honestly, myself, but I'm excited to learn, and we'll definitely be doing an episode on him. But... Joseph Campa's grandfather, Jacques, settled in Detroit 2 years after his brother, Michel, in what was at that time called Fort Pontchartrain, du Détroit, because it was just a military settlement at that point. In the first 3 years in Detroit, Jacques was granted two of the original 68 land grants given out by Cadillac to his officers, and his first role in the Detroit community was as a blacksmith, supplying the military with hinges, gun parts, and other miscellaneous materials that were not listed, but feels like a pretty important role in a small military fort settlement. As time went on, Jacques began to take part in the fur trade, which was the booming industry in the what we now call the Midwestern United States and Canada at the time. He opened a merchant shop in Detroit and amassed considerable wealth by the 1740s, and he fathered 12 children, one of them Jacques, who went on to be Joseph's father.
That's quite a few kids.
That is, and I wonder how many survived, because I don't mean to be dark, but the reason that people had a lot of kids back then was mostly due to the fact that it was not guaranteed a lot of them would live. And
that sucks.
That does suck.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, and I mean, I mean, maybe it was a fact of life at that point, but I don't think people like loved their kids any less back in the 1700s, you know? But it's interesting because that's part of the reason life expectancy numbers were so skewed.
Yes.
Because we learn, we always talk about today, why do we complain about modern medicine? Because our life expectancies are so much longer than they used to be. But in reality, they're not really.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that we've been able to curb is like infant mortality. Because back in like the 1700s, the life expectancy was like 50 years old instead of 70 years old because everybody lived to like 80 and then like a quarter of the population died
at like five at
or younger.
At the oldest, yeah.
Yeah, so that totally skews the number. If you take those numbers out from like back in the day, the life expectancy was extremely similar to what it is now.
I believe it.
But yes, so Jacques had 12 kids. One of them was Jacques, who was Joseph's father. And by all accounts, Joseph lived a normal but wealthy life of an early Detroit settler. But there was a lot of wealth because they were higher ranking members of military families. And the names you'll hear in this podcast are prevalent throughout Detroit. He was from a devout French Roman Catholic family, but actually spent a lot of time in his youth trading with Native Americans, which had not yet been all but wiped from the land that they basically founded and originally were on. I'd like to know what he was trading as a child with Native Americans, because that feels like, I don't know what his parents' thoughts were on Native Americans, but it was progressive to even interact with them really at the time, but I'm sure there was extreme, misconceptions and prejudice based on Native Americans. So like, you know, they were dehumanized, called savages. So I wonder what his parents thought about him trading. I would love to know more about
what he was trading.
Little 10-year-old Joseph Campo trading with Native Americans.
Guy was a businessman from the beginning.
Clearly. You got to watch out for those psychopaths.
Yeah. This whiskey's fucking good.
It is really good. I'm glad. This might be my actually favorite straight like whiskey from 2 James. They're all really good, but this one just has such a great flavor profile. Mm-hmm. So unique.
Mm-hmm.
So Campo grew up to be, by all accounts, a good-looking, savvy, and charismatic figure in Detroit. He was kind of in the upper echelons of society there, mover and shaker, socialite. According to C.M. Burton, who is one of Detroit's foremost historians, he was around in the early 20th century, but he pretty much documented everything important that happened in Detroit from its founding to, like, 1922. So important dude, but
thanks for that guy.
Yeah, thanks, C.M. Burton. Well, that's why the if you ever go to the Detroit Institute of Arts or the Detroit Public Library, they have a bunch of things named after Burton. The Detroit's like historical collection of archives is called the Burton Historical Collection.
Wow,
because he's like accounts for like 40% of its contents. I don't really know anything about him other than that. That's pretty sweet. But he noted that we'll hear his name a lot because he talked a lot about Campo, but he mentioned that Campo was educated in Montreal, which was a French settlement as well at the time, still kind of is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he went to college in Montreal, and while he was able to speak fluent English, he never lost his French accent his whole life, which is interesting to think of somebody born in Detroit, living in Detroit as it was a state towards his later life, in America, with a thick French accent.
You think that was intentional? Maybe like just to flex a little bit, be a little bit different?
Maybe. I mean, if you look at cities like New Orleans and at that point Detroit, I do think that as like the 1840s were around, not by the time the Industrial Revolution came around, but even probably up to the Civil War, I think the French influence in Detroit was extremely like there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it still is in a lot of little things we do, like our like diverse food culture or how our flag has fleur-de-lis as a city. But other than that, I mean, we're not like New Orleans, which is anymore, which is like still like extremely French, and the freaking state of Louisiana has like parishes, instead of counties. But
the capital is Baton Rouge.
Yeah, you know, freaking Red Stick.
Red Stick.
Yeah, dude. So it's not like that, but I think it did have a strong, because it was the biggest French city in the Midwest and was a huge trading post. So I don't know if it was a flex. If it was, that's kind of badass. But honestly, even
Charlie's
if it's not,
like, hey, I'm built different. I'm still a little bit French.
He's like, I know all you Americans are in here, but I'm built different. But the beyond his English and his ability to speak English and French, he actually spoke several Native American dialects, which was highly uncommon at the time. And it was mostly due to his childhood spent trading with Native Americans. He never had any official learning of Native American dialects or training, but, you know, like the best time to learn a language is when you're a kid, and he was able to
be immersed
and speak different dialects. And This would help him once he began to trade goods as an adult, taking after his family before him. But this came from his documentary, and documents about him, historical documents. I wish there was a Compo documentary. There is.
Make one.
We should. We might be the foremost subject on this eventually yeah, if we keep recording the same podcast over and over again.
We'll be experts.
Yeah. But he reportedly had a nickname amongst local tribes, which this comes from his biography, so I don't know how true this is, but again, even when he died, it wasn't cool to like Native Americans, so maybe it's the truth. But Chief Wawanosh of Sarnia and Chief Makuns of Lake St. Clair, I may have butchered those names, mm-hmm. I tried, affectionately called him Chemukamun, which was their native dialect for big shot. So
big shot.
The chiefs around the area allegedly called Kampo big shot.
You think that was like genuine?
I think they're maybe like facetious, here's Mr. Big Shot. Right.
Just like a little bit facetious, but like, probably took it.
Right. Facetious enough to where he didn't realize that it was facetious. And they're slighting him, but he felt cool that he was in close with the Native Americans.
Everybody patronizing, but he still gives them shit, whatever he ended up trading with them.
Yeah. I mean, we'll find out about what he was trading with them eventually. But in addition to trading with Native American tribes, Kampo also opened a store on Atwater Street, which is modern-day downtown mm-hmm. Detroit. And
a brewery.
It is a brewery named after the street. And actually, interestingly enough, Atwater is along the water, like even closer to the river than Jefferson. But it was not named because it was at the water. There was a dude named Atwater. Yes.
Was he named because he was born at the water? It has to come from that.
I mean, I'm sure originally his family name, there was born somewhere near the water. But I do think that, like, even though this street wasn't named because it was at the water, I do think they named Atwater Street that street, Atwater Street, because it was at the water. You know what I'm saying? Like, it works because it is at the water. But it's interesting. It's modern day downtown. It's where his store was. He began importing goods from much bigger and established Boston, which he was one of the first people. At that time, there wasn't a lot of interaction between the colonies out east and the French settlement. But
what about what year was this when he started trading with Boston?
It doesn't say, but it was around the time that I think it was becoming a territory of the United States. I don't know the exact time frame, but
it's like late 1700s,
right? Late 1700s, maybe early 1800s. I know by the early 1800s we were a territory of the United States, but there was a time where we were still French controlled after we gained independence from Britain.
It's pretty major to be trading with Boston.
Right, and nobody did that, which is why he amassed considerable wealth, because when you start trading with Boston, you get an obscene amount of resources at your disposal. Mm-hmm. So he was the first one to do it because he made enough money through his family to establish trading posts in what is today Saginaw, Lake St. Clair, and on Lake Erie, so he was able to move it up the river, the Detroit River, into the city.
It's a lot of land to cover.
Yes, it is, especially at that time when there's horse-drawn carriages with buggies. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it.
And so there's the Saginaw Bay, right? Which lake feeds into Saginaw Bay?
Lake Huron. So
he's got Huron, he's got Erie. He's got down Erie. To Lake St. Clair.
And if he's got, that's what I was going to say, then he's got Lake St. Clair, which connects to Detroit River and Lake Huron, based in, like, the Saginaw
Erie,
Bay.
Right?
No? Yeah, so it goes, like, the river up down from New York goes like Lake Ontario, and there's another little river, and then Lake Erie goes through Ohio to like mm-hmm. the southeastern tip of Michigan, like Monroe County.
So this guy is covering every eastern port of Michigan.
Yeah, impressive. Basically like what we call, like, you know, I said the first part podcast, like the eastern seaboard of Michigan, mm-hmm. whatever. I don't mm-hmm. know. Nobody uses that term, but yeah. For those of you that are from Michigan, you know how we...
The best part objectively about living in Michigan, by the way, is the hand map.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
it's something you always see in memes, and like mm-hmm. this is how we do it. But like, it is.
It's so much fucking easier.
Even when you're not telling people, it'd be like, this is how we say how we're from Michigan to people not from Michigan. I'm like, when I talk to people who are from Michigan, that's how I talk. Yeah, like, where are you from? I'm like, here,
right around here.
Yeah,
it's actually like pretty incredible to think about that. This is in a relatively accurate map.
It's like extremely accurate too. Like, it's really way more accurate.
Like,
than
what do you do if you're like Ohio?
Yeah, like, this is, or the people that get the shaft,
like Tennessee,
people in the Upper Peninsula, they're like, bow. But yeah, so Kampo made a good living trading, but real money started to flow in once he started trading with Boston, and he would start to buy up vacant lots aside from the lots that is the property that his family had already owned for generations. He would build on these vacant lots and sell them for a much higher price, but also lease houses built on the vacant lots. So his real estate prowess, he was kind of like the Detroit's first Dan Gilbert, but because he would lease these houses out, he was also kind of like Detroit's first landlord. So think of Joseph Campo as like a guy that traded and a mix between like your local landlord and Dan Gilbert.
This man had money on his mind.
Yes. And most accounts of Campo during this period painted a picture of a good and ethical businessman, but several historical papers call him Detroit's first, quote, slumlord.
Oh.
Which doesn't really surprise me because his obituary seemed to like try to like respond to those allegations with something that only somebody who was a slumlord would say. In his obituary, it said, quote, about his landlord being a landlord, it said, quote, to the honest and industrious, he was always lenient, unquote, which kind of sounds kind of like the thing that like, well, if you just comply, the cops won't shoot you.
That's what you say when you weren't very lenient.
I'm a good landlord if they do what I say. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm sure you're a good landlord to like your family, friends or whatever. But
so you say he would buy up land. So would he rent it?
So he would buy up land and build on it. And he would either sell it or rent it.
Either way, that's pretty cool.
Right. I mean he was Detroit's. They say he was like his Detroit's like first like real estate mogul, which is kind of cool. And I don't really have a problem with that, especially when they were building out Detroit. Like somebody was going to have to do it. I don't even have a problem with being a landlord. But, I mean, apparently he was a slumlord. But
yeah, it's a bit different.
But unfortunately, spoiler alert, this is far from the worst thing that Campo has done. So
stay tuned.
So yeah, we can, I guess, forgive the slumlord thing in exchange for his other sins. But C.M. Burton, back again, was documenting Campo's life and laid claim to the fact that Joseph Campo actually became Detroit's first millionaire. At his peak in the early 1800s, when Campo was in his 30s and early 40s, he was the territory of Michigan's largest landowner, owning property totaling up to more than $10 million.
Of
1800s money.
Wow.
Of 1805 money. He was a large stockholder in the Michigan Central Railroad and the Bank of Michigan, two institutions which have like surely would have made him like a shit ton of money if he went on to live through the Industrial Revolution, which he didn't. But I mean, he built enough generational wealth. He's fine. He still has like descendants living in the Detroit area.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know any of them personally. Well, maybe I do, honestly.
We gotta reach out to those people.
Yeah, we really should have had him on this podcast. Yeah, like, so how do you feel that you're about all these damning facts about your
great grandpa?
I can't really say anything though because through marriage, Louis Cass is a distant relative of me.
Oh,
and
wow.
For all the bad that Campo did, as far as I know, he did not help architect the Trail of Tears, so he can't be worse than Louis Cass. For reference about how much he was worth, $1 million in 1800 when Campo was 31 years old is equal to $20.6 million today. Wow. And $10 million is equal to $206.5 million. Now that's a lot. And I know it may not seem like much in terms of like a major city's most richest person.
Yeah, it's not that Dan Gilbert.
Because like I don't know how much Dan Gilbert's worth. I can look it up real quick.
He's the 42nd most richest person in the world.
Dan Gilbert's net worth is $44.1 billion.
Oh my God.
So compared to today, it's not the same, but it's still, I mean, $206.5 million is objectively a lot of money.
But I feel like there wasn't as extreme of a wealth gap as we're seeing now.
Well, so there isn't, and you have to remember that this was before people pushed the boundaries of modern capitalism. Like, this was before the Industrial Revolution, before, like, John D. Rockefeller and Cornelius Vanderbilt decided like they were going to overtake entire industry. Yes. Yes. I mean, you could argue he laid the groundwork for these type of people because he was able to, like, you know, build generational wealth, spread his money across different industries like real estate and fur trading. But it was before people, like, took over, like, it was back when like the politics were controlled by like politicians and not by giant corporations and obscenely wealthy people. So you got to remember at that time, $206.5 million was I don't know where he ranked among the country's richest people at that time, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was like top 10, 20, you know, like there wasn't a lot of people that had that much money at the time because nobody like monopolized and nobody had. And also these corporations very rarely, with the exception of like the East Indian Trading Company or whatever, you know what I'm talking about? Like, there are very little multinational corporations in the world at that time. So It's not like he could have real estate over in like freaking Africa or something, you know. Mm-hmm. He just had real estate in Detroit. But yeah, I mean, there were no such things really at that time, even in Michigan, in terms of, yeah, the Gilberts or the Myers or the DeVosses or the Fords. They just didn't exist 60 years before the Civil War. He had little to moderate influence financially outside of Michigan, but even that was honestly having any influence outside of Detroit was impressive at the time. But as many filthy rich men feel, business owning, trading, and slumlording was just not enough for Joseph Campo. It never is. He craved more, and he's held several office seats in Michigan's territorial government. In 1802, it was documented that he held six positions in the local government. He was a city trustee, which feels like a relatively important role in a small town. Mm-hmm. City inspector of water barrels. Not sure what he was doing with that. I also don't really know.
That's a cool one. I just want that title. I want that on my resume.
Yeah. Young. I'm going to be an artist, a young water barrel inspector. I don't know. What do you do? What do you inspect the barrels for? Like,
I mean,
make sure there's no leaks or something.
I guess that's important. Like, that's, I mean, was that like the main way to transport water? I mean, that's fairly important.
I don't know about water transportation because I know that we had like tamarack mm-hmm. pipes built by the Native mm-hmm. Americans that are still in use today from like the 1600s, which is incredible. But I don't know how they would transport it once the water was taken out of the pipes, right? Like, so probably barrels. But like, I don't think like water was like delivered like off the river in barrels.
In the barrel.
You know, so I don't know. But that's not the one that's the most confusing to me. So he was also the city assessor and the city appraiser, mm-hmm. which feels like a huge conflict of interest. Like, how are you going to appraise and assess land when you're like one of the biggest real estate moguls in the Midwest?
Like I said in the last one, it's like those rich people who buy art have their friend appraise it at an exorbitant value so that they could donate it for the tax write-off.
Yeah, like it's
like it's just a conflict of interest.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I'm sure the Rockefellers and Vanderbilts looked mm-hmm. up to at that time. Because I'm sure he was able to drive the cost of his land mm-hmm. immensely high as the overseer of that.
Or low when he wanted to buy it.
Correct. But another thing that he oversaw in a city position was the poor. And his actual position was overseer of the poor.
Overseer of the poor.
Which sounds very dark. Sounds extremely dark. But I did a little further research, and overseer of the poor was like an actual position based on like old English, like feudal lords and shit. Mm-hmm. Like they would have an overseer of the poor, but what they would do honestly is just be in charge of collecting taxes from the citizens that had money to distribute to the poor and oversee like the poorhouse is what they called it. So it actually sounds like, although I'm sure the power was abused at every turn, mm-hmm. it sounds at its core a pretty noble thing to do.
It's just a hilarious name for like probably a much more streamlined social program like welfare.
Yes.
But it's a funny name.
Right, like it would never fly today. Like imagine if you're like a welfare plan, like the poor people helper. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's kind of rude, dude. Yeah, you know?
Call it welfare.
Yeah, so I have no details about what he did or whether there was a poorhouse that he oversaw or what he did with the funds and where he diverted them to. But one thing I do know is that this felt like way too of an altruistic thing to do for somebody like Joseph Campo, and I'm just assuming that this was a purely political move, that whatever he was doing as the overseer of the poor was either a favor for a friend or doing something to get ahead, or maybe he like owned a poorhouse or mm-hmm. something and was something with that. Not enough details, but I just assume the worst.
Yeah, antitrust laws weren't really a thing then.
Yeah, no, as evidenced by his roles as six different positions in the city government. Yeah, so you cannot convince me that he didn't abuse these positions of power. I have no evidence. These are completely baseless accusations, other than the context I have of the time and the person that Campo was. But that wasn't actually all of Campo's political prowess. In 1802, he was an original trustee of incorporating Detroit as a city, etching his name in history, and was also a captain of the Michigan Territory's militia in 1806, and eventually made his way to a major in the U.S. Army during the War of 1812. So you can just, you know, check off those military service boxes. And again, I don't know what this was like, whether that was like an honorary position, because I know by 1812 he had like obscene amounts of money for that time. So feels like he wouldn't be like running out into combat. But again, it was a different time where military service was like noble. And I mean, it still is noble. I'm not saying it's not now, but I'm saying that like we could have a whole discourse about this, but you'll never see like a super rich person in their mid 30s
joining
like the front lines of the war. But you could argue that none of these things, while Campo set the groundwork for building Detroit into a major city in a lot of ways, arguably the lasting impression that Campo has had in Detroit, beyond, you know, land ownership and a major thoroughfare in his, of his namesake, was when Campo and his nephew, John R. Williams, which, yes, that John R.
John R.
Yes, we're right off John R.
Yeah.
That is the it is named after him. And fun fact, John R.'s middle name was R.
Just R?
Yes. like when like you can see like when I type here, like his name is not John R. with a dot Williams. Like it's just John, it's John R. Williams.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to give my kid just a letter.
My girlfriend, I guess I don't mean to put her on blast, but my girlfriend's middle name is N.
That's it?
Yes. Juliet N. It's like her, it's like she's Russian, and a Russian tradition is like naming like one of your middle names is after your father.
Mm-hmm.
And her father's name is Nikolai. So like, it's like Yulia Nikolaevna, but like something about her birth certificate, like they just made it Juliet N.
It's easier.
Yeah. So
maybe they were drunk when they signed
yeah,
it.
Yeah, maybe. So yeah, you know, it, it is what it is. So
I think that's common in like India too. I think Indians have letter names.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting the culture of naming like across the world, like especially because like, yeah, like it, like Juliet, my girlfriend, if she had lived in Ukraine or Russia where her family's from, she wouldn't have like her family's last name.
Mm-hmm.
Like her last name would be like a take on her dad's first name.
Yeah, and it's the same in Jewish or Middle Eastern culture too. You're like bin. Like if, like Osama bin Laden, his dad's name was probably Laden.
Yeah.
With a different last name.
Or like Osama of Laden.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Bin is like son of, or in Hebrew it's Ben.
Yeah.
Like Ben Moshe.
Well, one of my favorite favorite soccer players of the past 10 years who was kind of burned out his career, he was, I think he's from Israel. Okay. His name was Hatem Ben Arfa.
His dad's name is probably Arfa.
Yeah.
At one point or another, there was a father named Arfa.
Yep.
Pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. And then like in Africa, like my best friend is African, and his name is like he has his dad's last name because he was born here. But if he wasn't, he would have his first name, and his last name would be his grandpa's first name. Like,
wild.
Like his middle name. It ended up being his middle name. That's what happens a lot in America too. Is that they just end up making it a middle name as like a homage to to the culture, culture that they had to leave.
I don't want to deviate too far, but it is pretty incredible to think about last names and how a lot of white Americans' last names who come from Europeans, like they're job titles from different.
You know my last name,
Draper.
Where do you think that came from? Somebody in the past in my family was definitely draping some curtains somewhere. You know what I mean? It's so boring.
Yeah, right.
I like my last name, but when I think about it like that, I'm like, I'm really named after like somebody that made curtains. Like, that's fucked.
Or like German last names are usually just like weird, like Schwartz just means black.
Yeah.
Schwarzkopf, black head.
Yeah.
Literally what it means. Schmidt, anything Schmidt or something means Smith, like.
Well, and it's crazy if you like try to trace the linealogy of it, because like there are the lineage don't think is a word.
Genealogy.
Yeah. If you trace the lineage of it, like a lot of it also has changed when you come to America because of like the mass immigration to like Ellis Island. Like
easier.
My grandma, her family was Lebanese. Her last name is Lebanese, but her last name is Dennis. I'm like, that's not Lebanese.
That's not what it was.
It was Denise. It was like D-Y-N-I-S, like Denise. And then they said it at Ellis Island, and they're like, all right, Dennis.
Easy. Fucking go.
Yep.
Go to your segregated neighborhood and hate your life.
Yep. It's just so funny that I was like, Dennis. I'm like, that is definitely not a Lebanese.
Not a Lebanese name.
And because she's like half Lebanese, half Irish. So I'm like, that could sound Irish, Dennis.
Could be Irish.
But it was her dad's name, and her dad was Lebanese. So I was like, okay.
Something's fishy.
Something's here, but yeah, it's because of Denise.
All right, anyway, John R.
Anyway, about naming. Campo and his nephew, John R., created Detroit's first newspaper called the Democratic Free Press and the Michigan Intelligencer.
Ah, I hear Free Press in there.
Ah, which is weird. Have we been talking about the Free Press?
I've heard of it.
Oh, yeah. I heard they got some suspect naming. They got some suspect naming policies.
Yeah, we got to talk to them about that one.
But, yes, it is the Detroit Free Press. It's been continually operating ever since it was opened or began in the early 1800s and eventually was changed to the Detroit Free Press. But as somebody with a strong journalistic background and a true love for journalism, and I believe, yes.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, but I'm saying, as someone who loves journalism, has a strong background in it, and appreciates journalists, and appreciates free speech, I do think that's pretty cool that there's been that long lasting
free
newspaper.
Press is incredible,
and yeah, the free press is great. I love the free press as much as I talk shit during this podcast. I've done freelance stuff for the free press. I love it. And
oh, you have? I don't know that.
Yeah, yeah. I had, when I was writing for iSportsWeb, the MSU blog, I had like a weekly guest column.
Nice. That's really cool.
It was years ago, but I love the free press. They've been good to me, and they've been good to Detroit, and are always a nice voice of reason in the city. So thanks, Joseph Campo, I guess.
Thank you. And John R. Also.
John R. Williams, who also eventually became, I think, the governor.
A bad person, probably. Oh.
Oh, well, yes, yes, yes. We know that. There's something else he did. Like, he was the governor or the mayor or something eventually, which, yes, also solidifies he was probably bad. But so in his personal life, Joseph Campo had 8 children, so which was a lot in his own right. Not 12 like his grandfather, but he had 8 with his wife, and you may have heard his name, Adelaide de Quinder.
Mm. Two street names.
Adelaide is a little tiny street that I used to live on by Little Caesars Arena in Brush Park. But De Quinder is a major road that runs north-south on the east side. Adelaide was named after her specifically, but De Quinder was named after her family.
De Quinder goes pretty far north, huh?
Yeah, like I think it goes all the way up to like Mount Clemens, maybe, or something like that. Yeah. I mean, it goes, and it doesn't even go all the way down to Detroit. It stops. De Quinder becomes a 75 service drive by Hamtramck, actually. But yeah, so the De Quinder family was a wealthy French family rooted in Detroit's east side. She actually, so the wealth in Campos family stayed in the family. His daughter, Catherine, named after his mother, Catherine Menard.
Wow.
His daughter, Catherine, went on to marry Francis Palms, who was Detroit's largest landowner starting in the 1850s. And he also had several residences, Joseph Campo, in Detroit. His primary residence was a log cabin on the south side of Jefferson Avenue between Shelby and Griswold Streets, which, for those who don't know, it's exactly pretty much where Hart Plaza is today, which is like
pretty incredible,
extremely prime real estate in Detroit, like the heart of downtown right on the river. I don't know if his land property went all the way to the river, but I'm assuming it probably did. And he also owned a house, a little bit further down east on Jefferson, which actually still stands today. The log cabin is long gone. It's all built up modern stuff there, but his house on East Jefferson was built in the early 1830s. I'm not sure exactly when, but it still stands today in its original location. And it's on the National Register of Historic Places as the Joseph Campo House.
Very cool.
But he reportedly never actually lived there, which I'm curious about, because the way they describe his house was a log cabin, and if you see this house, I mean, I think they added a wraparound porch in like the last 100 years, but it's objectively a nice house, like big. It's like very like I don't know what the style is, but whatever you see like before Victorian, like if you go to like Boston and see the houses that were built in like the 1830s, 1820s.
Yeah, what
like,
are those called?
I don't know, like plantation houses. That's all I can think.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
I don't
way
know
to put it.
But yeah, so that's kind of what it looks like. But it's a beautiful relic of early Detroit, because most of the old Detroit architecture you see today that's still around, I mean, a lot of Detroit architecture, I would say a lot of the buildings in Detroit were built in like the 30s, but when you're in like Brush Park in like North End Detroit, there's a lot of old Victorian homes, which is, in my opinion, this is just subjective, but in my opinion, that's my favorite era of architecture, because the attention to detail is unbelievable. Like these, like, it's like the houses you see in scary movies, you know,
yeah,
like
incredible.
The old,
quite ornate.
Yes, but before that, it was a very functional the architecture, and that's what this house is. Like, you look at it, and it's just, like, paneling, and pretty, though, and really cool relic of history. And it's actually the second oldest structure in what was originally Detroit. Wow. The oldest structure is the Charles Trowbridge House, which was built two years before, and is, like, 2 doors down from the Joseph Campo House. So
Trowbridge, so, like, the street going in East Lansing?
Yeah, I mean, I assume it's similar. The only other Trowbridge I know is the street off 127 that goes into East Lansing. But I also feel like I should mention this. I had no other place to put this in the story chronologically, but just in passing, in C.M. Burton's documentation of Joseph Campo, he notes that at one point during his career, Campo bought a 9-year-old African boy.
He bought one.
He bought one, just purchased it.
He owned it?
Yep. During a trip to Montreal as a slave who was to be freed at 21 years of age. It doesn't say.
It's a pretty weird, like, souvenir.
And it's a weird way that C.M. Burton wrote it, because he never mentioned whether that he was freed at 21 years of age, or whether he made it to 21, or whether, like, what he was used for. And I mean, again, it's interesting, because we like to think of Detroit as a place that was like has always been a pillar of civil rights, which in a way it has. But also Detroit was and is today still one of the most segregated cities in the country and has had its fair share of racial problems. And in times before like abolitionism in the 1850s and 60s, there were still slaves here. It wasn't like down south where there was like fields of slaves working on cotton because that wasn't the industry up here. We had like manufacturing and really nothing actually at that point. But I mean, you know, it was never like fields of slaves up in the northern U.S., but which is why Campo, one of the richest men, didn't have like 100 slaves, but he still had one. I mean, this kid, maybe he like was like a servant or something. Doesn't make it okay. Doesn't make it any better, but it just leads credence to the fact that like, yes, there are still slaves up here. But yeah, so that kind of makes a slumlording seem pretty minor.
Yeah. It changes my thoughts on the guy a little bit.
Well, because it's interesting because with his trading with Native Americans, you're like, maybe this guy.
Cool guy.
I mean, I would say he probably didn't support the systematic genocide of Native Americans. Yeah. I can't say that he wasn't racist towards them.
But he was still happy to just purchase a human as they were.
Yeah, so that kind of all the cool parts about him talking to Native Americans kind of slashed by the fact that he purchased an African boy.
Whoops. I shouldn't have done that, Joseph.
Yeah, no. Oh, and John R. Williams, his nephew, also was reported to own slaves.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah, as cool as that family
may live off this guy's road.
Well, too late. History. Start a petition.
Yeah, I might.
Gretchen Whitmer is trying to change the name of Cass Tech High School.
Really?
Yeah, because of Lewis Cass. We saw Cobo Hall because, Cobo is a little bit more fresher of a wound because Cobo was the mayor of Detroit.
He was a fucking asshole in the 50s.
He was, but that's what I'm saying. It's a fresher wound. It was
much,
the 50s.
Much fresher than the early 1800s.
People seem to give people like that were in the early 1800s more of a pass for being garbage
Which
human beings.
Is understandable because it makes them no less garbage. It just makes the times indicative of garbage humanitarian ideals.
It doesn't make it an excuse, but it does lend credence to the fact the reason there were way more of them is not because humans were inherently worse at that time, is because we were inherently less further in our like progressiveness, you know. Like,
and I'm very, very happy that we have progressed the way.
I think if Joseph Campo grew up like today, well, obviously, he wouldn't have slaves if he grew up today, but I'm saying even if he grew up in, like, the 1950s, I really do believe that he would not be a segregationist or anything. Like, I do think he was not very racist for his time.
He just kind of, like, accepted the privileges.
The problem with Alfred Kobo was that even for his time in the 1950s, he was an excessively racist mayor.
Yes,
like, for the 50s. Like, he was in the news articles being like, wow, this guy is fucking racist. I don't think that people thought this way about Joseph Campo. In fact, I do believe that in this era, people looked at him as somewhat of a progressive for several reasons. Not just we'll see why, but so it doesn't excuse him. Still makes him a terrible person, but I do agree that it's a little bit different. Also, it's way different having a slave like Joseph Campo and enacting a genocide like Lewis Cass.
Yeah,
very different.
Agreed.
So,
but yeah, and I think it's like you said, it's very important to note. It's a very important piece of information when you're kind of formulating your thoughts on a person in history. It seems, you're right. Like, yes, ideals were very garbage when it comes to slavery in general. But it also seems like Joseph Campo, more than anything, was just reaping the benefits of being a white European American in the mid-1800s.
Right, exactly. Like, I do truly believe if Joseph Campo was around today, he would not be a segregationist. In fact, I do believe he'd probably be one of those people, like, posting brand activism or whatever, Black Square on Instagram on Blackout Tuesday, but
if it helped his money.
Right, but he also would be in the news for, like, I don't know.
He may also be the one evicting poor people because it's within the confines.
Right. He'd also be one buying up all the land in Midtown and then not building on it, you know, waiting for it.
Buying up low income housing because it's cheap.
Looking at you, Illich family. Anyway.
You know, Mike Illich, I mean, it's the one thing
except
that
Mike,
he paid for
except
Rosa
Mike
Parks
Illich
rent.
Is dead, dude. He's his family, dead. You know.
Yeah.
Mike Illich, by all accounts, is a pretty good dude. And I don't even think his family is terrible people. I'm not even saying that, but they have a really bad habit of buying up land and up and coming real estate places and then not doing anything with it for years.
It's pretty awful.
Which slows down the revitalization of these areas.
Yeah. I do like the anecdote about him paying Rosa Parks' rent, though. I think that's a pretty cool.
I actually think Mike Illich was a really good dude.
Yeah.
But
Do you think they should have named Little Caesars Arena Ilitch Arena?
Well, they named the business school next door Mike Ilitch School of Business. So
Ilitch Arena just rolls off the tongue.
It does. It does. And I mean, as much as I do think that, I actually don't hate Little Caesars. I usually hate brand named stadiums.
I don't mind LCA.
But Little Caesars is, like, it's a Detroit thing. You know what I'm saying?
It's
like,
banging pizza. Come on.
Yeah.
Say what you
hot
want.
Hot and ready.
A $5 stadium. Hot and ready goes crazy. Yeah. Even though it's like a $20 hot and ready at LCA,
yes,
which is
dude.
Pretty funny.
When I first went to LCA, dude, they had. Well, I went to the Little Caesars Pizza Bowl actually at mm-hmm. Ford Field,
oh, that's cool.
And they were selling me Hungry Howie's pizza. I'll never forget.
No
it.
Way.
Never forget it. It's because like Ford Field had like a deal with a vendor, like a Hungry Howie's
that's
vendor.
Still so funny.
Yeah, but I remember being like a 10-year-old kid, being
like
just
this
baffled.
Doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make any sense. But yeah, no, I do think that Mike Ilitch was a pretty good dude, and it's just a common. I mean, you see this with like lots of famous family, like Biden's family or even Trump's family or in the show Succession, like the patriarch of the family is generally always the best person because they have a different perspective. Once they get those riches, like I don't think these like the Ilitch children are inherently terrible people, but when you grow up as like the heir apparent to like a multi-million-dollar business and live in lavish wealth for years, like you lose perspective. And
yeah,
I do think that's what happened with them and why this is going on and why now the patriarch of the family, not that Mike Ilitch is some like perfect human, I'm sure he had some shortcomings, but he had the perspective. He grew up as like a poor kid, you know, and not that like, I don't mean to like sensationalize that, like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, the American dream shit, but like, it does when
it's typically
you
true for
when
the,
you lose
for the
that perspective, you make decisions.
The children, yeah.
Losing that perspective informs a lot of decisions and can explain a lot of these decisions that are made by children of wealthy people. But yeah, so Campo's life was interesting, but honestly, the most important part, interesting part of his life, calls back to his early days, but it happened later in life. So he was a member of the Catholic Church in Detroit, St. Anne's, which is still a Catholic church today, is now located in like the West Side industrial area, like kind of near Mexican Town, which is actually, I think it's majority Chaldean now, this Catholic church, which is
interesting.
But it was originally Roman Catholic, very French. At that time, it was overseen by the very famous Father Gabriel Richard, who actually went on to found University of Michigan, which was originally founded under a different name. I'm about to look. It was originally founded under...
Jamie, pull that up.
I'm pulling it up.
I don't know if you ever watch Joe Rogan.
No.
Yeah, we've talked about it. But his assistant's
like producer
name is Jamie.
Or something.
The producer and assistant, and that guy can find anything on Google in seconds.
Yeah.
So it's
we need a producer.
Like,
hey.
Jamie, pull that up.
Yeah.
And then he just pulls it up immediately.
If anybody is looking for an unpaid internship,
we'll pay you in whiskey.
We'll pay you in whiskey, and we'll buy you like a folding chair from Big Lots or something, and you can sit in the corner.
If there's a sale.
If there's a sale.
If not, you're getting a Facebook Marketplace fart chair.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Dude, I will not stand for this fart chair slander.
No, don't get me wrong. Fart chairs, they're absolute plays. I've had so many of them in college.
But yeah, because I don't really feel like pulling this up. But
I'm not buying new for a fucking intern.
But anyway, the father Detroit, like the father Gabriel Richard of Detroit, was born 1767, died 1832 at age 64. His crypt is in St. Anne's. But he helped found the University of Michigan, which was originally called the Catholepistimiad. Catholepistimiad.
What's his pistimiad suffix? Can we expand on that?
Let's try to Google search it and bring them up to the mic and see. Catholepistimiad. I looked it up, and literally the only thing that it shows is the history of the University of Michigan. So it must be a name unique to Michigan.
Can I see the word?
Yes. You try to pronounce it.
Catholepistimiad.
Catholepistimiad.
Catholepistimiad. Pistimiad?
Just sounds,
way,
it sounds dirty, dude.
Yeah,
it sounds dirty. But anyway, it was founded in Detroit. University of Michigan was originally in Detroit. Father Gabriel Richard helped found it. So he's famous in his own right in Detroit. But he was the head of St. Anne's Catholic Church. And the tension between him and one of its members, Joseph Campo, was a long-standing tension and was waiting to break at any moment. Years prior, around the turn of the century, Campo's aforementioned nephew and slave owner, John R. Williams, was campaigning for a political seat in Detroit and was facing Richard. And as the uncle of John R. Williams and someone who is just morally opposed, apparently, to a priest running for political office, because he was... So here's another reason why I think Campo was looked at as a progressive, was because he was big into the separation of church and state, which was not big at that time, beyond, especially in the Roman Catholic sects. But also, even though he held a seat in the Roman Catholic Church in Detroit, he was apparently never very religious, which was interesting to me. In a small settlement, I do think religion has, you know, less and less people are extremely religious, but in early America, it was a huge part of life. And socially, too, you know, like social life was a lot different if you weren't a part of your church. But he was opposed to Richard running for a political seat, so supported his nephew. And John R. vowed to leave the church if Richard was elected. Richard won. John R. stayed true to the word and left the church. This had a profound impact on Campo's attitude towards the church and was really just the beginning of their beef. A few years later, Campo got really interested in the life of being a Mason. He became a Freemason, which was really...
Which I need to look more into.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting, the history of Freemasonry. But one thing you do know, I'm sure, about it is that it is very frowned on by the church. Mm-hmm. They think it's like devil-worshipping, Illuminati shit. And Father Richard held a lot of negative animosity towards Campo because of this, but couldn't really do anything because Campo kept paying for his seat. In the Catholic Church, which was giving them
fair
money,
enough,
and like he was an upstanding pillar of Detroit society, like it would have been really controversial to like kick him out. But he rarely attended the church. He kept his seat, never went. Devoted all his time to the Masonry. He became like whatever, like the master of the Grand Lodge of Detroit or something. But then a few years later, Campo was caught selling whiskey to Native Americans, more trading Native Americans, which doesn't seem bad, but I know we talked about this last time. You really shed a light on the downfall of selling whiskey to Native Americans.
Yeah, I mean, so from the accounts that I've seen, so I went to Central Michigan University. We're on Native American reservations, and there's a very amazing and informative museum there. I hope to go again. The Jibwig Center, I believe that's what it's called. And yeah, there was a whole area devoted to how white Europeans who came and settled in the Americas intentionally introduced and traded alcohol with Native Americans in order to allow them to become inebriated and much more willing to sign treaties that were most likely unfavorable to them land-wise. And it turns out that, I mean, From what I've seen, I don't want to make this claim like it's true unless I'm not fully aware. But what it seems like is that that's contributed to the disproportionate amount of alcoholism within the Native American community.
Yeah, I mean, the CDC has noted time and time again that the alcoholism rate amongst the Native American population in America is like significantly higher than any other ethnic population in the country.
So while it may be just Joseph Campo being the homie, given some Native Americans some whiskey, whatever they're giving him back, arrows or something, or whatever they make or hunt, it seems like I can't let that piece of information slide without at least noting that it's a possibility that there was some ill intentions behind it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And given the past of Joseph Campo, you cannot put that past him.
Yeah.
But either way, regardless of his intentions, Father Gabriel Richard was not happy with it. And he was
Richard
already
didn't like the Native Americans.
Richard, I don't know if he liked the Native Americans or didn't like the immorality of alcohol or the fact that Campo
so was immoral back then. I mean, is it now? Like I said, I don't know too much about Catholicism.
I honestly,
whichever.
I don't really
was
know
it,
much.
Was it Catholicism?
Yeah, they were Roman Catholics. I don't really know much either. I don't think booze is necessarily extremely frowned upon, but I think it might be a little bit of like a sin, you know, like a vice. And
you can only do it on Fridays or something.
Right, and not only that, I don't think if he was selling whiskey to white people, Gabriel Richard would have been mad. I think like if he had a tavern or something, I don't think he would have been mad, but I think he's mad.
Especially with the importance of mission and conversion of Native Americans to assimilate ones who move in and steal their land. Like, we're going to steal your land, we're going to get you drunk, and then make you our religion.
Right.
Sucks.
And I think that Gabriel Richard probably just held disdain for Native Americans because, I mean, at that time, I mean, he was a priest. Catholicism was everything in that guy's life, more so than even the average American at that point. So I think it was just, and given the fact that Campo was already on Father Richard's last nerves, he was probably like, this fucking guy.
Yeah.
He was like, now he's selling whiskey to Native Americans, you know? So The animosity was actually compounded immensely by an incident in 1817 when the original St. Anne's Church burned down and its location at the time on Jefferson Avenue near what is today Greektown.
Did that just happen often? Did things just burn down?
Yes.
All the time?
I mean, it was not until like Albert Kahn in like the late 1800s in Detroit, the architect started building things with a lot of brick and steel. Mm. That most buildings were built in with wood.
And they would just burn.
And they would just, I mean, it was just a very common thing.
Because they were also heated with fire. That's all.
It was a fact of life. Shit just burned a lot. So that was kind of actually a footnote here. It's just setting the tone for the rest of the story. So the original church burned down. And the church was poised to be built further east in Detroit towards Larned Street. Because there was a larger population of Roman Catholics in that neighborhood. And Father Gabriel Richard was like, this is perfect. It actually gives a good opportunity. But Campo was not happy because he owned land right next to the church's original location on Jefferson and knew that if the church was built in the same neighborhood, his real estate value would go way up on his property. So even though he was raised Roman Catholic, like I said before, religion was not important to Campo. He didn't really care about this stuff, but he feigned this belief, which Father Gabriel Richard saw right through. He knew this guy didn't really care, but he was like, basically what he did is he gathered all these other French Roman Catholic like settlers in Detroit and was like, look, if he has to move the church, he's going to have to like dig up all these bodies in the cemetery that was next door and move it, which is kind of like, you don't want to disturb the dead. Like, that's not okay.
Doesn't sound cool.
And like CM Burton said was, quote, personally, Campo didn't care much to be near a church or even in a church, but the sharp speculator would use the church for his material advancement. So yeah, he got all these French settlers to campaign Richard against moving the church's location because he would have to dig up old bodies, move them. So the grassroots support for Campo got so strong with the French settlers in the area that Campo and his bastion of followers decided, fuck it, we're just going to break ground on this new church on the same location ourselves without Richard's consent. And Father Dennison, who was another Detroit priest, witnessed the event of the groundbreaking and said, quote, Campo, to hold his followers in line and to dishearten Father Richard, attempted a building of the church near the site. The foundation was laid and the cornerstone was blessed by himself, mockingly, with a bottle of whiskey.
That's pretty incredible.
So this dude who is in trouble for selling whiskey to Native Americans decided he was going to break ground without Richard's consent on this church and christened it with a bottle of whiskey. Like,
that's
that is
pretty phenomenal.
It would be OG trolling.
Full circle, yeah,
it's like OG trolling, dude. So as a result of Campo refusing to compromise a single one of his personal beliefs and mocking the most powerful priest in Detroit, believing he was too big to fail, Father Richard and the Catholic Church threatened to have Campo excommunicated from the Catholic Church if he did not admit to apologize for his sins in confession. And a prominent figure of the Roman Catholic Church in America, Bishop Blagé of Bardstown, Kentucky.
How do you spell that?
Blaget. It might be Blagget, but I feel like since it's like a Blagget. Russian church. I mean, it's just a Roman Catholic Church in French.
Especially in Kentucky, yeah.
Yeah, like Blagé.
That sounds about
I'm
right.
trying, man. I'm trying
no,
with this pronunciation.
Like
he traveled to Detroit to hear Campo's confession, and it was just a miscommunication because Richard was under the impression that, like I was saying, like the Catholic Church was such an integral part of society and social life in Detroit that he was like, Campo can't leave the church. You know, he can't. He's going to lose all his business partners. He's going to lose all these people he would do business with. Campo was like, F you, dude. I got the Masons. I'm a big enough businessman. People like me. Like, I'm good. So the dude came all the way up for, I don't know if this is the exact reason this Bishop Blagé came up, but the bishop in America came up to hear Campo out, and Campo never showed up to the confession and thus was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. So
he just didn't show up.
From like 1817 to his death in like the 1860s, right before the Civil War, he died. He lived to like his 90s, Campo, and
it's pretty cool.
For like the last like 50 years of his life, he was not allowed in any Catholic establishment, and was also not allowed to be buried in the Catholic ceremony. But he died in 1863. He was 94. And at the time of his death, his estate was still worth $3 million, which still made him the richest man in the state at the time. And he was buried at Detroit's Elmwood Cemetery, although he wasn't allowed to have a Catholic burial. You can still see that he was liked in the Masons. And the Masons gave him, I don't know the metrics here, but C.M. Burton said it was the biggest, the Masons gave him the biggest funeral service ever in Detroit up to that time.
That's pretty amazing.
I don't know what that means. It feels kind of Trumpian.
Like,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, if Trump was like,
it like
was,
just a when weird I have
when I have my funeral,
yeah,
it will be the biggest the funeral. There will be billions of people there.
Oh God.
But anyway, yeah, so he had the biggest funeral, so clearly he did not suffer from being excommunicated, which I think also is really interesting about his legacy overall, because in a time that's so focused on the church, he was able to just kind of realize that money talks, and if you have enough money and enough connections, it doesn't matter what your religion is, it doesn't matter whether you're kicked out of your church or not, you'll still be successful, and... Even though I think that, I mean, I just really want to talk and get your perspective on Campo's legacy, because he obviously had prominence and family wealth at his disposal, which a lot of rich people did. But I want to know, like, what do you think his legacy is? Because not only did he create the Detroit Free Press, which I think is a cool lasting legacy locally, and was like the first real estate mogul slash slumlord, but I just can't help but wonder, like, what would Campo have become if he was born like 30 years later and lived through the Industrial Revolution and had that capital to be a part of it in a burgeoning place in terms of manufacturing and culture.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, after all the info you gave me and after kind of hearing some of the context, what's cool to think is Campo's business mindset from the beginning, progressive ideals, which... We think of, I mean, when we think of progressive now, we think of, you know, as we're in the context of late stage capitalism, which I like to think that we are currently.
I would hope so.
We think of progressives as eat the rich, this, that, you know, we hate the capitalists, just whatever. But when we think about Campo's time, the norm was devout religion and probably racism and white supremacy to an extent. And we think about Campo, someone who was interactive with the Native Americans, as someone who was focused on building wealth up, while, as you mentioned, it was necessary and I think crucial to his success, the fact that he had generational wealth to him, but also just the fact that he was able to kind of think so broadly in regard to trading with Boston, for example, utilizing Michigan's ports.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting how we view progressiveness as a positive thing. And I would like to be known, it is.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, the connotation in which progressiveness is associated, I think it's good. But you have to remember that was progressive for that time.
Yeah,
like in a time you're saying when people were focused on family, they weren't focused on like figuring out the loopholes in the system and gaming mm-hmm. it. They were figuring about sustenance, survival, family, religion.
Yep. You Absolutely. Know?
And he was the first to be like, fuck that, dude. I got a bunch of money at my disposal. Yep.
I'm going to figure out how to make more out of it.
Yeah.
And that's what's pretty cool is he figured out how to make more out of it. And being in the mid-1800s, prior to the Industrial Revolution, to kind of start pouncing on these capitalistic ideas and becoming a landowner with the intent to flip the land at a higher value. We're going to not necessarily mention the conflicts of interest with his government positions, but fuck it. I mean, the idea that, yeah, he bought land to sell it for more. He traded with Native Americans, probably not because he probably didn't give a fuck about the color of their skin or their lineage. He just cared about ways to be productive in society. He figured out ways
to... able to shed his, like, functional fixedness mm-hmm. about life. Like, I think at that time, like, we talk about how you talk about we're in late-stage capitalism. We were not at that time.
Barely capitalism.
Yeah, it was early-stage capitalism.
When did Adam Smith write Wealth of Nations? Please let me know.
Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, came out in 1778.
Okay.
Campo was born in 1769. So Campo
was nine years old when Adam Smith
released Wealth of Nations.
Yeah. So he was born before that book was released. So obviously capitalism in its whole was not
as we know it today.
Yes,
100%.
Exactly.
So I do think like that. You're right. Like he at that point it was progressive to realize the potential of capitalism. Like, I don't think people realize at that point like capitalism was cool and it was a new concept to people about, like, you know, being able to, like, the American dream was starting to be born. But I don't think people realized at that time that, like, I think Campo's the first to realize, like, there's going to be a winner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, somebody's got to win.
That's a huge thing. And I think that there are definitely some negative effects, you know, from these sorts of things, as we're kind of experiencing now with an overwhelming wealth gap, with loopholes in overly complex tax laws, in I mean, just...
just how advanced we are as a society these days, it's pretty incredible to see how making it or, you know, getting rich is so different than it was then. Because back then, it was exactly what he saw. He saw, I can procure things of value, and I can sell them for more. I can position myself in society as a charismatic, friendly person in a way to allow my goods and services to be perceived as a higher value. Mm-hmm. And I think that those qualities are fucking incredible for the early 1800s. And I think that his effect was twofold. I mean, so one, as I mentioned, is that it's pretty incredible to see someone jump on an ideal to create and build wealth. Because we have to hope and we have to assume that his wealth created more wealth, right? And I think that's the biggest and most positive aspect of capitalism, is that those who are entrepreneurial tend to create more wealth than those who follow the norm. So although we don't have any specific stories, I like to hope that through his moves, he created more wealth and more success in the entirety of Detroit and Michigan. On another note, the fact that he was in Detroit is pretty cool.
I mean, you have to remember, like, even at the time of his death, I don't know exactly Detroit's population in the 1860s, but it was before the Industrial Revolution. It was not, like, a huge town. Mm-hmm. And not only was it not, I mean, it was a relatively big town, but the biggest thing about it was that so separated from the happening area mm-hmm. in the United States. So the fact that he was able to make, like, really, really, really something of himself at that time is a testament to those capitalist tendencies. And I want to note, like, as bad as capitalism to me is right now, and I'm like, very...
The word kind of hurts to come out of your mouth,
right?
Because of how it's
because honestly, right now capitalism sucks. But the thing is this is how societies work. It's cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
When capitalism was first created in America, it did this country an extreme amount of good, like extreme amount of good. But again, eventually, it runs its course. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at the end of the day, the main goal of capitalism is like monopoly. Like somebody's going to win.
Yep.
Somebody's just going to have all the monies.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, so once we start forgetting, or once we start realizing that we are not all, it's an interesting thing to say, but we're not all one person under God with an equal playing field and an even plane. That's when we can start advancing on our strengths.
Yeah. And like, you just look at any society in history, all successful societies, the number one trait of successful societies was a willingness and ability to adapt to yep. changing landscapes. Yep. And that's what happens. Jefferson knew it when he was writing the Declaration of Independence. If you told our founding fathers that the Bill of Rights that they created and the democracy they built would last for like 250 years, they'd be like, no fucking way, dude. Yeah. They'd be like, no way.
Yeah.
No way.
Like, yeah, can you imagine that your laws are being argued in court with the CEOs
in the year
of
2020?
Google, Facebook, and Twitter are fighting because they believe that your laws, like, it's unbelievable.
It's obscene. They'd be like, why don't they change?
Yeah.
They'd
yeah.
be like, you know what I mean? Like, Jefferson
stop
was
being a textualist.
Jefferson especially was a student of history, right? And that's why he was able, like, it's actually impressive that we've lasted this long with the exact system, like, pretty much the mm-hmm. exact same system. But Jefferson would say, I know he would say, you can make your comments about whether Jefferson was good or bad. He was probably actually a pretty shitty person, but, like, very smart dude.
Mm.
Bar none. Very mm-hmm. smart dude. And he knew what worked. And he also knew that eventually things have to change, you know? Like, it's cyclical. Like, eventually capitalism runs its course, and the next natural step is socialism. And then after that, like, the next natural step, as much as we might not like it, it's authoritarianism. But that's just the cycle of how humans act. And you have to have a willingness to change and adapt.
Let's see what happens.
You know, but my whole point going back to Compo is that at that point, we didn't have to adapt. At that point, you're 20, 30 mm-hmm. years into capitalism in America.
Yep.
And he was one of the first to realize, like, wow, this system is something I could totally take advantage of.
I can step beyond the religion and the, you know, the status quo, if you will, of being a white supremacist, because I would like to believe that every white American then was a white supremacist.
They believe, no doubt.
So stepping beyond being a white supremacist, being a human that both separates yourself from the godliness of the Catholic Church as well as from the supremacy of being above the Native Americans, for example, allowed him to understand that, hey, I'm a dude and I'm given a couple privileges. I'm going to go jump on these. And the other really exciting thing, and why I'm happy that this is the first person we're talking about in this podcast, is that He did this in Michigan. He did this in Detroit. He did this outside of the 13 colonies and outside of the coastal states. And he was able to run trade with Boston. He was able to convey the value of Detroit's location and Detroit's resources with Boston. I mean, when we think about the late 1700s and the early 1800s, that's the city we think about.
Yep, 100%. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that he, because of these reasons, he played a huge role in laying the groundwork for Detroit to become the absolute booming metropolis it became in the 1900s.
There's no way that the manufacturing city of Detroit would have been what it was without
the foundation that existed.
He created that foundation, and it's
like, do you think people incredible. Like Henry Ford would have stayed in Detroit if there wasn't at least a groundwork there for some sort of semblance of success?
I although it's impossible to do the math, I would like to consider the lasting effect that Joseph Campeau has left on the city of Detroit.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way you can quantify it, but you have to at least mention that it's there. I mean, you can't, anybody that's a historian that knows about Joseph Campeau would tell you that, because he really did set that groundwork. Like, you
mass can be land ownership.
You can be successful here. You can't just be successful here. Like, you can be successful here and have influence on the city and surrounding areas.
Connections with cities hundreds and hundreds of miles away. Ownership of mass amounts of land. Influence beyond the Catholic Church. And there's, I mean, there's tons of characteristics that Joseph Campeau possessed and perpetuated within Detroit and the state of Michigan to his family members, which, as we see, generational wealth, and you can't really do this stuff without the privilege. I think that's very important to note, that these are things that probably couldn't have been done by a lot of these people in history without the privilege and the wealth that they were born into. But They could have sat back and accepted it. They could have sat back and been rich because their dad was rich. They could have went to church. They could have paid for their seat at church. They could have been loved by the Catholic Church, had 12 kids, and died.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And what I'm saying, like, and I think you echo this sentiment, we're not doing this podcast because Joseph Campeau pulled himself up by his bootstraps and made something of himself. That dude was going to be rich and wealthy and probably going to have a street named after him somewhere in Detroit, regardless. But it's the fact that he was able, like, you have to sometimes separate, in terms of looking in a historical context, it's very nuanced, like you said last podcast, and you have to look at it separating the person from what they did.
Quite important.
Like, you take away the fact that Campeau was probably a terrible person and did a lot of fucked up shit, and realize, like, he was able to push the envelope in terms of innovation and possibilities in this area. And for that, we have to be thankful, not for him, but for what he was able to show us.
Exactly. It's not binary. It's not bad man did bad things for society. No, in this case, it's bad man did pretty fucking cool things for society when you think about it historically. And exactly. I mean, it's nuanced.
It wasn't the slaves he owned that changed Detroit.
That was the bad part.
Yeah, that was the bad part.
But it is nuanced, and it's important to understand and appreciate these figures in history, whilst fully aware of the negative impacts they may have had, but appreciating and understanding that this person was able to develop a mindset and a system that created Detroit. And Detroit has been vastly influential on the success of America during the Industrial Revolution.
100%. As much as you can say about the ups and downs of the city, ever since, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, this country, we would not be where we are as a country today. We got where we are on the backs of cities like Detroit, on the backs of these industrial cities that changed the landscape of American culture. So really, I mean, you can't say, like, Joseph Campeau is the most important man in America by any means, but, like, it's really interesting to see that somebody that nobody really knows anything about played a huge helping hand, a huge role in developing a city that became the backbone of American culture.
And that's why we call this podcast The Lost Souls of Detroit. I mean, he really is a lost soul of Detroit. He is a silent player in a silent city, to be honest. Nowadays, when we think about the success of the United States, we think about LA, we think about New York. Detroit's just right there in the middle with a insane history, and it's, I think, Lost Souls, for example. I mean, I think that's a great name for this podcast, because the city of Detroit itself is a lost soul.
It is a lost soul, and like, it's kind of a double entendre too, because Detroit, for a city of its size and its stature, which is at this point not, it's, I don't know where it ranks amongst the biggest cities in the country, but it's got to be like 40 maybe.
By area or by population?
Population.
Low.
Like, you think it's lower than 40?
Maybe.
Either way, we can agree that it's not very high, and but there's so much soul that comes out of Detroit. Not just the soul music, not just the Motown, which, yeah, okay, it did. But like, Detroit, like, think about all the influential people, even in America, that have come from Detroit over the last 100 years compared to Detroit's place in America. Like, I think it lends credence to the fact that Detroit is such an important city because we've birthed so many different innovations. Cars. We changed cars. We changed music. We changed so many different things that, given our size, we really shouldn't have. And I think that groundwork was laid by the people. I mean, it just permeates through generations, right? And the people that are here, given all the context before them, boom, boom, boom. It's not like people in Detroit are just born inherently more talented than other cities per person.
Mm-hmm. They're bred. I mean, they're bred by the city of Detroit.
They're bred by the context. The culture
and the history and the rich context of a certain lifestyle. And it's pretty beautiful. So,
and it has to start somewhere, you know. And I'm not saying it started specifically with Joseph Campo, but like I was saying at the beginning of the podcast, he might be the person you can call like the first person to achieve true success, fame, and iconography from that was born in Detroit.
Yep.
Like Father Richard, okay. Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac, okay. Augustus Woodward. Okay, none of those guys were born in Detroit, though. Joseph Campo was born in Detroit in 1769. So
that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool. So
thank you for giving us a little bit of history.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm here for. So that's a good place to end, kind of get going off that topic of why we call it what we are. But yeah, I mean, that's all we have today on the Lost Souls of Detroit. I hope you enjoy, everybody. Remember to read your history. Drink your water and drink your liquor, specifically Catcher's Rye.
By Two James today, Distillery.
By Two James Distillery. Go down to Corktown, get it. Or if you live in Metro Detroit, they have any good liquor store will have Two James.
Did you like Amore's?
That's my favorite.
The guys who own it are the nicest men in the world.
Guy was super nice. They had a ton of options, but I was kind of looking for something in Detroit, and I saw the Two James like row.
Yep.
And I was like, I'm going to get
Amore's
that.
Amore's the best. If they don't have something you want, they'll get it for you within the hour. I'm not kidding.
That's amazing.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, shout out to Amore's. Another Metro Detroit staple. Shout out to...
Go to Amore's on Madison Height. John R. and 11 Mile.
Yeah. Solid place. Guys. Solid place. I didn't bring Southern Comfort.
Thank fucking God. You sent me that picture. I was like, fuck.
I can't believe you took it seriously.
I was in the middle of a game of fucking Rocket League. I was just like, really? And I was like, well, I was like mentally preparing myself for the possibility that you just said fuck it and bought a pint of Southern
Comfort. If I bought a pint of Southern Comfort, would you have drank it with me?
I would have. I would have drank the whole thing with you. I don't have to work tomorrow. Fuck.
That's all that matters. But yeah, so that's all we have today on the Lost Souls of Detroit. Thanks for tuning in. You can send me Max. You don't really have the social medias like I do.
Yeah, but I got. I mean, yeah, not for promotion, but
yeah, you have social medias, but your shit's locked.
Instagram,
but
Instagram's public. MaxMiller82.
MaxMiller82 on Instagram or at JamDraper on Twitter. You can send us comments
that's the better place to do it.
Send us requests or like email. I guess you can email us. I don't know, Jameson.Draper@gmail.com. However you want to get in touch with us, email us. Give us suggestions.
That's my succulent.
That's a cactus, dude.
Yeah, that shit's sharp.
Oof.
Maron.
Oof, Maron. All right. This podcast is quickly derailing. Thanks for listening, everybody. Tune in next time.